Hello, I am Farha Khan. This is Prof Talk. Last July, UBC welcomed Gage Averill, a world-renowned ethnomusicologist, as the new dean in the Faculty of Arts. Gage Averill's research focuses on the ideological context of music production with special attention to the role that music and expressive culture play in social transformation. An author of numerous articles and books, his most recent publications have been on issues of music, peace, and violence, and the role of world music ensembles in teaching ethnomusicology. His research specializes in popular music of the Caribbean and North American vernacular music. He's also considered a Haitian scholar and has recently finished editing a 10-CD box set of music and film originally recorded in Haiti in the 1930s by folklorist Alan Lomax. It's called Alan Lomax in Haiti, 1936 to 1937. These recordings have nominated him for a Grammy Award for the Best Album Notes category, which he will be attending on February 13th at the 53rd Annual Grammy Awards in Los Angeles. Gage Averill joins me now in the CITR studio. Thank you, Gage, for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me here.
So let's begin with talking about your relatively new role as Dean of Arts here at UBC. I mean, you've joined us from the University of Toronto, where you were Vice Principal, Academic, and Dean. How has this transition been for you?
Well, I love the weather. So that's been great. And I love UBC. One of the things that attracted me here was, of course, the dynamism of the university. And I found this a very open and refreshing place to be. It's a big and complicated faculty, so I'm on this extraordinary learning curve, especially during my first year, visiting all the departments, visiting all the buildings that we use, learning the ropes. But it's been exciting, and I think some good things are going on.
Awesome. The Faculty of Arts is one of the largest faculties on campus. I mean, what is your vision for the faculty?
By the way, the largest.
The largest.
In fact, apparently the largest in BC. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Just bragging.
Right. So what is your vision for such a large faculty?
Well, we have a university vision, which I think fits very nicely. And it was another one of the things that attracted me to UBC. So President Toop and the university crafted the Place and Promise plan, and it applies beautifully. So we are, on the one hand, strengthening our research, but doing lots of work to create new styles of teaching and new forms of pedagogy, new distance education on the teaching side, and looking at an international horizon in terms of our programs, our research collaborations, our recruitment of students, very much. Looking to Asia, our connections to Asia across the Pacific, strengthening Aboriginal initiatives. We are going to be doing lots on the creative and performing arts. There'll be announcements coming in the next few months, which I think will really reshape the landscape here. We're going to be going looking at issues of how we increase the impact of our economics department and some of our key departments. So there's a whole range of initiatives from buildings to new programs. There's a lot on the plate.
Now, in what ways do you engage with the students and professors in your faculty?
Well, let's start with students because that's the fun part, the funnest part. I love the faculty as well, but we will be setting up AUS will be setting up the Meet the Deans and Meet the Dean sessions. We just had this first of these, although it was for the first and second year students a little while back. But I've also had the opportunity to visit a lot of other student contexts. So, for example, the other night when we had the job fair, or co-op students, and on and on. So I've been visiting different groups of students and talking about the faculty and where we go. In my first day, famously we had this little gig out on the mall with Xbox Rock Band with some students. So, but I've also been visiting all of the departments and listening to the research that our faculty do. The faculty have been talking to me about their teaching mission as well, and hearing some of the perspective, what life looks like in the departments. So that my nightmare is being one of those deans for whom their sense of what's going on out there is translated by people rather than getting it firsthand. So I'm doing my best under the circumstances to get out there and get some firsthand sense of what this place looks like.
So what are the students telling you about the Faculty of Arts that they're in.
Well, interestingly enough, I find that our students here are the most lively and grounded students I've ever met. And this isn't radio talk, right? This is the truth for me. But interestingly enough, a number of students have talked about how can we raise the profile of art students and essentially build morale. I mean, I think there was a historical legacy of feeling that the University of British Columbia was best known for life sciences and some of our professional schools, and that arts was kind of somehow, although we are at the center of the university, somehow peripheral, or less likely to get jobs, or you know, a number of problems that they've raised with the profile of art students. So I'll be speaking a lot on that and engaging with students on this issue, because I think art students are in the new economy the most likely to succeed. I think they're going to be the ones who are most literate, the most global, the best position to work in teams, the best position to go out and make that transition to the community with a great ability to speak, et cetera. So I actually think we should just be turning that whole model around, and other, you know, the students who are making more specific or narrow choices will have to wonder why they didn't get the kind of broad arts training, but also focused look at the world that you get in arts.
Now, I really enjoyed reading one of the mission statements on the Faculty of Arts website, which says, "To be human is to wonder, to seek meaning, to discover. Our mission is to nurture this humanness, to educate our students in this humanness." What does that mean to you?
Well, I have to say, when I say things like that, sometimes the eyeballs start rolling at, you know, and I have to balance those going out with things that I feel really strongly about, which are aspirational and rather idealistic in nature. So I will talk about the role of the arts in reflecting on humanity, which is really what that statement gets to, and also about the importance of transformational learning, because we just don't want students to come here, master a little area of knowledge, and walk out the doors. We really fundamentally want them changed, opened up, connected to the world, turned on in ways they'd never turned on by ideas, and so that those are areas that I like to, or little themes I like to hit, because I think we need to keep coming back to what we're doing, what the mandate is, what the mission is, and the mission is to create students who will, you know, I know it's trite to say be leaders, but be thought leaders who will be the people who will understand the transformations that the society and the world are undergoing, and actually get in there and shift them if need be, and make them happen. Who will take on major problems in the world, and all of these are interdisciplinary, mm-hmm. and help solve them, chip away at these, so that whatever we do, we leave a better world. For children, grandchildren, and so on. I've been talking in our little brief talk here today about things that attracted me here. But another one was that UBC isn't afraid to say this, that we want to change the world, that we want to have an impact on the world, and that's really inspirational to me. So I like to try and channel that in expressions like the one you read, to make sure that we keep looking at the big shining issues that will inspire us and guide us through this.
What are the kinds of things you hope to achieve as Dean of Arts here?
Well, I'd like to give our students and our faculty, just talking about facilities and layout and space, the kinds of facilities that encourage what they want to do. So we want all the spaces to be student-friendly so students can gather, talk, open their laptops, engage the world's knowledge, and I think we have a ways to go to transform the university to feel like that. I think too many of our departments, too many of our students feel like they're housed in substandard facilities. Anyone who on this campus who is in a hut feels that way, I think. So UBC is engaged in a campaign to renovate our facilities, and arts is going to be, I hope, leading the way. We're doing the Buchanan Courtyard renewal right now, and renewing the Buchanan buildings, and on and on. So we want to transform the space. In a part of our faculty devoted to the creative and performing arts, it's not clear where those units sit and how we encourage all of our students to engage in creative activity. So I'd love to see us transform the spaces around those units so that performance and creative engagement take place inside, outside, and that we invite the community onto campus and make it much easier for them to get here, but also that we take everything we do on campus, not just in the creative and performing arts, but in the humanities, social science, make sure it's out in the community. So another thing I'd love to to leave would be a more dynamic connectivity between the campus and our students. Good budgets and the rest, all those deanly kind of things. And I think finding ways to make allow our students to get out into the community and out into and across the globe in ways that are meaningful for them, that leave a legacy throughout their lives that they can follow, that allow them to be better global citizens.
And you did mention earlier about interdisciplinary research. How important is that to you or to students and faculty in the Faculty of Arts?
Well, let me start with me. I come from a discipline, ethnomusicology, which is a kind of a blend of anthropology and musicology with some linguistics and all various other things thrown in, folklore. So my training is ridiculously interdisciplinary, but I believe in disciplinary training. I think we need tools and we need to understand the history of the disciplines, and we need to be good at it. We don't want to become just mediocre at doing everything. But that said, once we have that kind of training, if we look at the critical issues where we want to apply it, famously, this university is devoted to sustainability, but ecological crises, every one of them requires chemical and knowledge of chemistry and of biology and ecology, and also of putting of mobilizing social units and solving political problems and an engagement with the philosophy. So you want to be able to put people together to do that. Give them the understanding of the interdisciplinary map and allow them to seek out connections to solve problems. I mean, that for me, that's the critical piece interdisciplinarity, and we need to be able to teach students to do that. So it happens in the classroom, happens in research, and partnerships. So when we talk about putting interdisciplinarity in centers or in individual places, I go a little bit nuts, because I think what we need is to make interdisciplinary connections possible for every student, every faculty member, wherever they work and wherever they study.
I'd like to talk now about your research as an ethnomusicologist, and you've put together this incredible CD collection titled Alan Lomax in Haiti. But before we talk about it, let's listen to a brief introduction to the collection that you have put together.
Great, thanks.
On December 10th, 1936, I was sent to Haiti to make a field recording study of Haitian folk music. I returned to Washington in the latter part of April with 58 10-inch and 236 12th-inch aluminum discs on which Elizabeth Lomax and I recorded some 1,500 Haitian songs and drum rhythms. These records, along with 350 feet of motion picture film of Haitian dances and the notes pertaining to the songs and dances, have become part of the archive of American folk song.
Thank you.
They were beautiful.
Yeah, thanks.
Gage, tell us about these recordings. Who was Alan Lomax, and what kind of Haitian music did he record?
Oh, God. Well, Alan Lomax grew up in his father's shadow, I have to say, in Texas. His father was an English professor who began to collect, what they understood as folk songs in that day, which would included cowboy songs and prisoner chain gang songs and the like. And by the time he was 19, Alan began to go out on his own. He hooked up with the very well-known African-American author Zora Neale Hurston to record through the South, and where they went to Bahamas. And by this point, Alan was wondering a lot about the legacy of Africa among former slaves in the United States, and was hearing connections between these various African-American musics. And thought to go to Haiti to, with the encouragement of Zora Neale Hurston, to better understand the African connection in the New World. And Haiti had just become independent from the American colonizer, the American occupation, and so it was a great time to go. America was kind of intrigued by Haiti and all that sensational stuff they had been reading about zombies and voodoo, and so Alan and a few other people, he wasn't alone at the time, a few other ethnographers and anthropologists, went to Haiti at the time. Zora Neale Hurston was there. The dancer Catherine Dunham was in Haiti. And Alan started in the city, but traveled to a number of other areas of Haiti, recorded, the reader pointed out earlier, 1,500 albums. And he recorded almost anything he could get his hands on. I think he turned down a few things, like the brass band that he wasn't interested in. He recorded just a couple of little bits of classical music because he had to. But by and large, he was interested in what he would call the people's music, you know, mm-hmm. the music of working people and peasants.
And children.
And children, yeah. We had... if you look at all the things that are involved there, you mentioned children, but he has two or three... Well, I guess five recordings of Boy Scout songs on that album from a little town in northern Haiti. There are certainly children's music. We heard just a snip of something that would have gone very well in that Italian show earlier, which sounded like Southern European guys droning in old European modes, and that was a French romance that were hundreds of years old being sung in Haiti. There's lots of voodoo liturgical or ceremonial music, but of different types, but also voodoo songs sung by individuals, popular music. We heard a waltz near the end of that, mm-hmm. that clip, instrumental popular music, and jazz. So it goes on and on. It's quite staggering, actually, the diversity of stuff that he was able to get his hands on.
Now, Haiti is a country with such an extraordinary history and culture. What first attracted you to the place?
I was an ethnomusicology student who was playing Latin music, and I wanted to work in the Caribbean. Since I was playing mostly Cuban music, I thought I'll go to Cuba. And then the political realities of being an American, I was living in the States at the time, going to Cuba set in. It would have been impossible to go for more than an illegal couple weeks to do work. So I began to look around, and I had used to do radio, and world music radio, and I remembered a piece that fascinated me from Haiti, and I played it, and then I searched out a series of recordings of this stuff called Ra-Ra music, which we have on this compilation, and began. It was so puzzling, I just couldn't make heads or tails of it. So I became fascinated by it, and I began learning Creole and seeking out Haitians in Seattle, where I used to live. That was it. I was stuck.
Now, just a little more than exactly a year ago, Haiti was hit with such a devastating earthquake. Yeah. How did the earthquake affect you personally, given all of your intimate ties to Haitian culture?
Yeah, I think everyone who was deeply involved in Haiti, I think, spent time just feeling this as a personal, familial friend issue. You know, you wonder about everyone you know, where they are, if they're safe. I stayed many times in a school that I had heard collapsed, so I was distraught about the possibility that there had been many injuries there. I'd heard stories about musicians I knew on the streets or who had lost relatives. So there was a period of focus on this, human aspect. And we had just come out with the set, mm-hmm. and we were working with the Clinton Global Initiative, mm-hmm. Bill Clinton's group, and with the Green Foundation, mm-hmm. on getting the recordings back to Haiti, mm-hmm. in various ways, and connecting, meeting descendants of the people recorded, and getting them into local centers and libraries. But this completely changed everything. We had no idea. I had no idea what to do for a little while with this, and then people on the ground in Haiti and the foundations began to talk about the need to use PSAs to raise awareness or to send the sets around for fundraising, and then to go back to Haiti and start dealing with the question of how Haiti rebuilds culturally. So, interestingly enough, I hadn't thought about this, but the box set turned out to be an interesting tool, I guess. Mm-hmm. And we began going back to Haiti and organizing around that.
So you've been back since, and how has the music scene been revived there?
Well, the first time I was back was beginning of April, I think, for a few weeks. And at the time, there was no music performance going on. I saw the first sign for a concert that had been up in the 3 months in Haiti. But at the time, when we took this the set out to Laogan, which was in the epicenter of the quake, there was a community group that organized a voodoo ceremony with music for us and for the set. And so, you could get a sense that there was this going on in neighborhoods still, a kind of continuity of music performance. And we may have all read or heard examples of people singing in the camps, people singing through the amputations without mm-hmm. any medication. Mm-hmm. So song had I think, been important in the process, and certainly in all the work that was going on in the reconstruction. But, in fact, so much, so many musicians were dislocated. There's hardly any place to play. It will be a generation before anything like normalcy returns to the music scene. I don't think popular bands are performing very much still.
Have these historic recordings been played on radio in Haiti, or have the people been able to hear them?
Yeah, we began getting little snips, little PSAs to the Haitian radio stations that survived, and they began playing this right away. They've done films of people interacting with the historical sounds, and they've taken these films around to some of the tent cities and the ghetto neighborhoods in Haiti. So people are hearing this. I described one encounter. I was up on stage, and we began showing a rah-rah from Laogan on the screen, playing one of the movies that Lomax had taken. And people jumped up in this, sitting in a cow field, and started screaming, "That's my grandfather, that's my grandfather." So people have been reacting to it on a personal level as well. And right now, I think the more things we have out there that remind people of, the richness of the culture, and both internally in Haiti and externally to the world, and the generosity of the Haitian spirit and the cultural richness of the country, I think the better. I think the more we expose this, it's the better.
There was something that was said in an earlier interview with you about this collection is a way of keeping the souls of the departed together.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite powerful.
Yeah, that actually came from someone else. I mentioned earlier Catherine Dunham, the dancer, and I had only met Catherine once or twice, but it was very brief. I don't think she remembered me when I was asked to introduce her with a speech at University of Chicago, and she was, quite old at the time and in a wheelchair part-time. And so I walked over to her. I was on stage opening my computer and remembered I had all these recordings that were of the Voodoo Peristyle, the Voodoo Temple in the town called Pompidou. And that's the Voodoo Peristyle where she was initiated into Voodoo back in 1935. And so I thought, wow, these are the people that she talks about in her book. So I sort of tiptoed over to her on the side of the stage. She was behind the curtain in her wheelchair. And I said, Ms. Dunham, would you mind if I played some recordings of Cecile Esperance and Mambo Teoline and some of your friends? And she looked at me. It was really kind of dumbstruck. I said, You mean there were recordings of them? Yeah. So she had no idea. She hadn't heard their voices in decades and decades. So I played these recordings for the audience, and then I introduced Ms. Dunham, and she came up and she was crying and said, you know, young man, and she turned around and pointed at me. She said, you have a GOV in there, a digital GOV, pointing to my computer. And the GOV is these kanari or GOV, they're these pots that you have in voodoo temples where when people pass on, the part of the souls reside there temporarily. And so she was alluding to the fact that there's something really soul-like in the... in having the voices of the ancestors in this way, kind of a touching moment, and it changed my whole approach to the project in a way, really.
That's fantastic. Now, you've been nominated for a Grammy Award for this collection, and it includes 163 pages of album notes. What was your reaction when you first heard that you were nominated for a Grammy?
Yeah, well, we had thought about the possibility of Grammy nomination a long time ago. The producer had raised this. And then we didn't get it out in time, and so a year went by, and Haiti happened, the earthquake. So we had other things on our mind, and I think I only thought about it once the whole time. So I got up in the morning, and I found at 5 o'clock in the morning a friend had sent an email saying, congratulations. So I opened it up and got kind of excited. So I was trying to be very calm about this, and I'm just going to go back to bed, you know. I'll wake up a couple hours later and let my wife and daughter know. And I was lying there with my eyes bug open, you know. Okay, forget that. I'm pretty excited. This is totally cool. And so I got up and started texting. I crawled in, to my daughter's bed and said, you know, Fiona, wake up. Daddy's been nominated for a Grammy. And guess who I'm up against in the historical category? She said, who? You know, all tired. She's 7 years old. And I said, the Beatles, you know, like your box set. And she said, you mean my Beatles? And I said, yeah. She said, oh, well, at least it was nice to be nominated, Daddy. And so she, you know, she totally realized perhaps in the historical category we're toast. But I'm not sure that she's not secretly rooting for the Beatles. It's a little family issue we have to work out. But we have these two nominations. One is for the notes, and that's under my name, and the other's for the project. So it goes under the producer's name, and that's the historical category. So notes are history. We have two chances. So let's see how it goes.
Fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you, Gage. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you today, and thank you so much for coming
it's
in.
It's been lovely to talk with you, and we'll do it again sometime.
Yes, and best of luck at the Grammy Awards.
I'll let you know what happens.
Yeah. I've just been speaking with Dean of Arts Gage Averill, who is the author of the book A Day for the Hunter, A Day for the Prey, Popular Music and Power in Haiti, and who has most recently been nominated for a Grammy Award for a collection of CDs titled Alan Lomax in Haiti, Recordings for the Library of Congress, 1936 to 1937. Now I'd like to play a piece from that collection titled Messi Papa Vincent with an introduction again by Gage Averill. Here it is.
And on one of Alan Lomax's first nights in Haiti, when he was still in the capital area, he was invited to an elite club called the Club Torland. And he went to this event, and it was to welcome the president of the Dominican Republic, President Trujillo, to Haiti. He was in the country for Christmas. So this is Christmas Eve, December 24th in 1936. And Alan Lomax set up his recording equipment at the Torland Club and captured this small dance band called Surprise Jazz, or Surprise Jazz. And the song that they're playing is a praise song for the current president of Haiti, Estenio Vincent. And the lyrics are essentially, this is a guy who loves the people. That's President Vincent. It's President Vincent who gives us the commerce in detail. And that, in Haiti, that means the people who sell things on the streets. He gives that to us because he kicked out the foreigners. He kicked out the Syrians who were doing that. And we're crying out, thank you, President Vincent. So this is a type of song you would have heard at any point in Haitian history, a praise poet, a praise song or a praise poem for the president. But it was very popular in this period right after the Americans left Haiti because it was President Vincent who was in power and helped the transition from the Americans back to full sovereignty for Haiti. So for many years after the Americans left in 1934, Vincent was a pretty popular president.
listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've had the pleasure of having Dean of Arts Gage Averill on the show today. In 2 weeks, I will speak with Dr. Carlos Ventura, who is currently the director of the Earthquake Engineering Research Facility at UBC. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, please visit CITR.ca and do check out our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today.
Do you hear what I'm hearing? Come enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost. I'm just